The Laura Murphy Show, Episode 18.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode 18 of the Laura Murphy Show. I'm one of your hosts, Bob Murphy. With me, as usual, is Carlos. Carlos, how's it going?
I'm doing great, Bob. Thank you.
Now, it's ironic, folks. I'm actually back in Nashville temporarily, bringing my son here to see some friends and clean out my old office. And so Carlos and I are very close. We're like within several miles of each other. But we realized, I said, should I go to your house and we just record both from there? And he said, well, no, because you'd have to be in another room so we wouldn't get echo effects. And that just seemed kind of weird. So anyway, we're not exactly in the same location, but we're very close, closer than normal. Now, in this episode, folks, this is part two of our series on what the member of the general public ought to do before trying to implement IBC. Okay, so in episode 17, just to review, we gave you the required and supplemental readings for what you needed to do to bone up on the theory of IBC to make sure you really understood what it was before you plunged into it. So very briefly, just to review some of the key points, we were saying if you wanted to just lightly dip your toe in the water, the first thing to do, of course, is to listen to all of the podcast series that we've done here in the Laura Murphy Show. And remember, the URL for this is LARA-MURPHY.com, LaraMurphy.com. You can see the archives of the podcast. Then also go to the newcomers tab. When you first get to LaraMurphy.com, the top right, there's a thing there saying new to Austrian economics, IBC. And you just start clicking around there and you'll see analysis at various levels of intensity depending on your interests and preferences. All right. So you go there, get caught up. But then clearly what you need to do if you're interested in IBC is get Nelson Nash's book, Becoming Your Own Banker. All right. You should not get an IBC policy if you have not looked at Nelson's book. All right. Because that really gives you the theory of IBC. You can see what he meant by it. And I mean, that's more important even than reading Carlos in my book, which is How Privatized Banking Really Works. So, of course, we want you to read that as well to really see why Austrian economics and IBC go hand in hand. But you really should get Nelson's book first. And so I'll stop there, Carlos. Is there anything else you want to summarize before we talk about the finder?
No, other than I'm glad to see you back in Nashville. we've had a hard week this week. I mean, because we've already given one seminar to a whole group of business owners. And now here you are. You've got me working on weekends again. So it's been a hard week. I'm waiting for you to go home.
Yeah. Laura Murphy Show is not a union shop, folks, just so you know that. Yes. Okay. So once you've gotten up to speed with the theory, you've read a bunch of stuff, the next major step is going to be to you need to actually find a financial professional who can give you one of these policies if you're interested in it. And it's, again, we've said this before, we'll keep saying it. Nelson wrote his book, Becoming Your Own Banker, for the general public, right? So there's a lot of stuff that one would need to know about properly configuring a dividend-paying whole life policy so that it optimally allows you to do the things you want to do regarding IBC, and that's not in Nelson's book. Once you know about those features and those subtleties, if you go and reread Nelson's book, you can see it parts, oh, yeah, he had that in mind here, but it wouldn't have jumped out at you. You would not know that just from reading Nelson's book because, again, his is for the general public. Financial professionals need additional training to know how to give someone a properly designed IBC policy, as it were. So that is the function of the IBC practitioner program, which Carlos, I, Nelson Nash, and David Stearns developed. And we've had financial professionals go through there. They take a test, or they study. We have a big textbook. They have training videos. They then take a test and sign a contract with us and then ultimately get on what we call the practitioner finder. All right. So that is at infinitebanking.org/finder. Okay. And we'll put a link to that too at the show notes page here. for the archives of this particular Laura Murphy episode 18 show. All right, so that's the Finder now shows you people, financial professionals who have graduated from our program. And so we are strongly recommending that rather than just grabbing some random life insurance agent and say, hey, I'm into this IBC stuff. Do you know how to do this? Well, the person might say, oh, yeah, sure, I can do that. Not because the person's a liar, but because the person doesn't know what he doesn't know. All right. So you want to go to someone who's been through our program, the Finder. You get them off the Finder. It's broken down by state. And so you can see people who are close to you. And people have different personalities. Or there's all kinds of people on the Finder catering to different types of clients. And so you just go ahead and, you know, you don't need to go to the first person you click. I can look around, look at their websites, make some inquiries, do whatever you need to do to feel comfortable working with somebody in that capacity. But now what we're talking about here in episode 18 is we're saying, okay, you know who you're going to go meet and everything, but we want you just to review some things, be aware of some things before you go and have that first meeting or that first Skype session if you're doing the thing over the internet. This is what we think you should have in mind beforehand just to make sure you're going in as informed as possible to make the meeting as productive as possible. So before I start jumping into my list, Carlos, do you have any other prefatory remarks here?
Let me just remind the listeners of this. Keep in mind that we created this educational program for financial professionals in 2013. Now, Mr. Nash has been promoting the IBC concept for well over maybe 12 years. So there are a lot of folks out there that have heard Mr. Nash either in seminars, they've read his book, and have been practicing IBC, you know, on their own prior to the formation of our training program. So there, as Bob said, there are people out there that have been doing IBC for a while, and some of them are financial professionals, and so they can say, I know how to properly design an IBC policy. On the other hand, when we formed the practitioner program, you know, for various reasons, but one of them was because we want to make sure that the practitioners that we're sending the general public to when we speak to you, we know for a fact that these folks have come into the program, they've gone through all the testing, and we feel that they are competent to design one of these policies. So that's very, very important. Now, another thing to mention here is that when you go to the Finder, you're going to find all kinds of different financial professionals. You're going to have individuals that may have been financial professionals for 5, 10, 15 years or more. They're very competent in that field. They have various licenses. So you're liable to, you know, be talking to a CPA. You may be talking to an attorney, a wealth management professional that has money under management. You may be talking to CFPs, which are certified financial professionals. You may be talking to CLUs, which are people that are basically insurance advisors. There's going to be different kinds of financial professionals on the Practitioner Finder, which will have had numerous years of experience in the financial services industry. Now what they've decided, because they've heard of IBC, is that they want to add this concept, you know, to their practice and show this practice, teach this practice to their own clients, you see. All right, so some of these individuals may be new to IBC. We do not let them come on to the Finder until they have been actually put together with an experienced, authorized IBC practitioner for a while until they're competent enough to know what they're doing before we actually let them go on the Finder. We still have many students that are going through the program. You will not find students on the Finder. You will only find those that have actually gone through the entire course. Okay, so this is very important to make sure you understand. And Robert's already mentioned a very important part of that is that these practitioners that are on the Finder have actually signed a contract with the practitioner program, which is us, which basically tells them that if you come on the Finder and you engage them in a conversation and start talking about, I heard about IBC, I found you're on the Finder, this individual may be an individual who sells mutual funds, he may sell stocks, he may sell real estate, but see, you've all automatically have changed the conversation the minute you said that you're interested in getting a privatized banking policy, an IBC policy, a dividend paying whole life policy. It automatically changes the conversation. Now that financial professional is dealing with you with just that. And that's exactly what the how the conversation should go once you go there.
Okay, thanks, Carlos. So let's dive right in here to some of the tips we want to give you guys and gals before you have that first conversation, just to make sure you're more educated and keep the thing going smoothly. So first of all, I want to just stress, make sure whoever you're dealing with, if you think you're getting something that is suitable for IBC, flip the thing around, look at the contractual language, make sure what you're actually being shown is a dividend paying whole life insurance policy. All right, because that is what Nelson Nash has always said is the gold standard, as it were, and that's the thing that's most appropriate to implement IBC with. All right, and we say that because we think, you know, so anybody, let me make two points. Number one, people who come through our program, if you get someone off the Finder, that's just going to be a given because they, part of their agreement with us, their contractual, you know, arrangement they signed in terms of what their duties are, if they're going to become one of our practitioners and be on the Finder, is they are agreeing, saying, you know, we're not handcuffing them. They're allowed to deal with other clients from the general public who may want other types of life insurance policies that do different things. But we're just saying if somebody comes to you via our Finder or, you know, you get an email and they say, hey, I've been listening to this podcast or I read this guy Nelson Nash's book, I want one of these things. Any kind of mechanism by which somebody is interested in IBC and the work of Nelson and Carlos and me in terms of evangelizing and bringing this information to the public, anybody who finds somebody who's in our program through those mechanisms and says, tell me more, I want one of these IBC or Nelson Nash or privatized banking policies, we're saying you have to give that person a dividend-paying whole life insurance policy. All right, so make sure that that's what's happening. The other point I'll make is because we know that there are some people out there who are saying, hey, you know, you can actually do IBC even better with one of these types of policies. Don't constrain yourself with those old-fashioned fuddy-duddy whole life policies. We understand what those people mean, and they may even, you know, be sincere about it. I understand where some of them are coming from in terms of having more versatility and such, but the problem is those other types of policies, things could, if you don't watch them carefully, things can go south on you, right? And so that's the overarching rationale for why don't mess with something that works. What you can do, anything you want to do with IBC using a dividend-paying whole life policy, that's the workhorse. That's what Nelson has always said, and so that's why, you know, we being part of the Nelson Nash Institute stand by that. And anybody you get off of our Finder is automatically going to be dealing with that product with you. But we just wanted to again stress that you can see how much time I've spent on that particular point here. That is critical. Make sure if you think you're doing IBC, you're doing it with a dividend paying whole life policy. All right, Carlos, I've beaten that horse to death. Do you want to kick it in the head some more too? Or
no, I think you've made your point. I think that's very clear. I think at this point, maybe we just, again, repeat, once you go to the Finder, you're looking around. Now you're matching up personalities, right? Because the personalities have to fit. You're probably going to have a conversation with this individual, and you're going to ask him questions, and, you know, you're going to see if you fit personality-wise. And Bob's already said there's other practitioners out there. You might want to talk to several of them, and I think that's a good idea to do that. Keep in mind also that the practitioners on this Finder, not only have they been taught IBC, but they've also been taught the basic fundamentals of Austrian economics. So if there's people in our audience, you know, that are Austrians already in their thinking, these practitioners also have the basic concepts of Austrian economics. So that's also a very good thing. Other than that, I think we would now be approaching, you know, the actual dollars going into these policies. In other words, and that's for you to be making the decision of how much money you want to put into these policies and conveying this information over to the practitioner. And you would be basically saying, I have X number of dollars to put into something like this, and how would you advise that I do this? All right. And we're going to reduce it down to just two simple ways in which you may be having this conversation. And I guess I'll go ahead and jump in and talk about the first one. And that's a simple one. I mean, it will be one of, you have a certain amount of unencumbered money, discretionary money, that you want to put into one of these policies, either on a monthly basis or on an annual basis. And you would basically be talking to this financial professional about how much that amount is. All right, so that would be one way in which that conversation would go. If you're talking about discretionary money that you have available, that's unencumbered, you know, you don't have to pay bills, debts, or whatever. And this is more or less the money you want to save for the future, but you're also using it to capitalize one of these IBC policies.
Well, thanks, Carlos. So yes, folks, there are two main patterns for when people first hear about IBC and then they go and talk to somebody and say, hey, I want to take out one of these policies. All right. So in reality, of course, there's a spectrum in between these things, but so we're just giving you the two extreme ends of the spectrum. So one thing which Carlos had just talked about is where you just look at your finances, your monthly budget, let's say, and you say, you know what, we could free up such and such dollars a month to devote to funding one of these IBC policies designed the way that Nelson Nash likes and recommends. And so you would go to the financial professional, which you found on the practitioner finder, and you would say that. You'd say, yep, this is how much per month I want to put into one of these things. So what, you know, show me the numbers. What does that look like? And you're doing that just out of your cash flow. Another approach, and this is particularly relevant for people who are older when they first hear about IBC and they want to dive into it as quickly as possible, is if you have assets elsewhere that you decide you would rather reallocate some of that away from those original assets and move it into one of these dividend paying whole life policies. So my point is, you can fund one of these things more heavily up front, and it's not that you're on the hook then for making those large contributions indefinitely. There's a way to move large amounts of money into a dividend paying whole life policy, sort of front loading it, if you will, and then you're not contractually obligated to keep making such large premium contributions going forward. All right. So what you would then be doing is, you would be the one to show up at that first meeting, just, you know, give the numbers just so the practitioner has an idea of what you're thinking about and what you have in mind and the scope of your undertaking. And then the practitioner can give you all sorts of options, you know, taking your idea as a starting point to just show you, okay, here's different ways, you know, because there's a lot of tax considerations and things like that as far as how would you structure one of these policies to make sure you're availing yourself of all the benefits and so forth of a properly designed dividend paying whole life policy that does all these things. So it's not worth our time for us to try to get into all the weeds on that right now, but what we are saying is there are reasons for us telling you all this stuff. There's also a lot of regulatory things constraining financial professionals. The federal government makes it very difficult for a financial professional to tell the client what he thinks may be in the client's best interest if that involves shifting money out of 401ks and things like that. All right. So there's FINRA has all sorts of guidelines, and now the Department of Labor has issued new guidelines that are coming out, or that are going to go into effect next year, just constraining the behaviors, not just of life insurance professionals, but just across the board, people working in the financial services industry who may end up acting in a fiduciary capacity with their clients. And so it's not worth us getting into it for the purposes of this episode. I'm just giving you some of the background to explain why it can just be a lot more helpful if you show up with an idea of this is the kind of funding level I want to do either indefinitely going forward with this thing per month because that's the cash flow I have, or, hey, up front, I have this amount in other places that I want to reallocate and put into one of these policies. So how do I go about doing that? You show me the options. That those are the kind of things that it'd be good if you're the one volunteering that initially when you first meet with the person you get out the practitioner finder. Okay, so Carlos, I will now turn it back over to you, and I'm sure you can elaborate and say these things in your own words.
Okay, so you more or less have talked about the second way in which you would be putting money into these policies. The first one I just described as just a simple amount of money. You know, it's unencumbered money. You're talking to the practitioner about, I have X number of dollars that I want to put into these policies on a monthly or an annual basis. All right. And so now the practitioner, what he's going to do is that he's going to create what they call an illustration. Now, the illustration is sort of a set of documents and projections that have both guaranteed values on it and then non-guaranteed values on it. And they're for you to study and for him to explain, showing where your money's going in every month or on an annual basis and how the money grows. And then he's going to walk you through what you already know about taking policy loans for big ticket sales. You know, he'll talk to you about that and make sure you're comfortable with what you're looking at. You've become comfortable. Oh, okay, this is a dividend paying whole life insurance policy. All right, well, then the two of you are going to decide, okay, this is what I want. This is what I came to get. And then what the practitioner's next going to do is he'll take an application from you. Now, in filling out that application, by law, he's going to have to ask you some questions about your personal life, you know, your occupation, how much income you make, and questions about your, you know, your assets and your liabilities and that sort of thing, because he in taking that application for the purposes of the insurance company, that information has to be provided to the insurance company. The other thing that he has to provide the insurance company is a medical on you. So he will call in to have a medical done on you. Now, this is a practitioner that does that kind of thing. It's not a financial professional. It's a health professional. He will actually come to your home or your office and run you through a series of, you know, health tests, ask you questions to find out if you're insurable. Not everybody can get insurance. So you'll go through that step. And then, of course, the policy then goes through underwriting, and, you know, eventually you wind up with your insurance contract. Now, that's the steps. But now here's a situation where Bob was talking about. It might not just be monthly payments or even an annual payment, but you may have a big stockpile of money invested somewhere else. And or, you know, say the stock market or mutual funds or the bond market, or you may have a qualified plan of some sort, like a 401k, 403b. What Bob is trying to tell you is that it would be very important for you to recognize that if you're going to pull that money out because you're getting uneasy about the markets or whatever, if you're going to pull that money out, there are taxes that have to be paid, because usually money that's invested has taxes that have to be paid, either capital gains tax, or if it's a qualified plan, you're going to have to deal with the deferred tax. You're not going to get away from that. So in order to pull that money out and free it up, there's going to be taxes that have to be paid. So it's very important that you talk to your own accountant about that, because even a financial professional can't give you tax and legal advice, you see. So you basically make the conversation flow better if you already know you know, how much money like that you have to put in. You already know what kind of taxes you have to pay, and you set that money aside. And now you're coming to the financial professional and you're saying to him, okay, I've got this big pile of money. I've already talked to my accountant and everything. I know what the taxes are going to be. So I'm going to have this big pile now to put into one of these policies. Can you set me up a dividend paying whole life insurance policy to accommodate this big pile of money? And we have folks that put quite a bit of money that way. Okay. So that's the main thing that Robert's trying to get across to you in dealing with these big piles of money that are invested, because they're coming out of an invested area into an after-tax product. Okay. You know, once they come, it's an IBC, a dividend paying whole life policy, is an after-tax product. Once that money goes in there, if it's properly designed and you borrow from it, pay back like you're supposed to, you will never pay taxes again. All right. So that's the important thing.
Thanks, Carlos. Let me talk a little bit about the actual procedure. So as Carlos says, just so you know what to expect, when you're meeting with somebody talking about one of these policies, at some point in the conversation, they are going to start showing you what's called illustrations. And these are projections that are typically generated with software provided by the particular life insurance company so that they know what the nuances are of their particular product. And when you're looking at those things, and eventually one of those will be part of the actual contract that you sign. And so I just want to make sure you know what those things are saying. So on one side, it's going to be on the left-hand side, at least all the ones I've ever seen, is going to be the guaranteed projections. And then on the right-hand side is going to be the non-guaranteed. And so the difference there is if it's guaranteed, and so the numbers are going to be smaller, right? It'll look less impressive on the guaranteed side. The non-guaranteed will look better. But the guarantees are saying, as the name suggests, or as the term suggests, there, the life insurance company is saying contractually, we are on the hook. We are guaranteeing that if you keep making your premium payments as this policy calls for, according to this timetable, you will see what the surrender cash value is at various points along the way. So at particular years, you'll see how much cash you would get if you surrendered the policy and so on. All right. So those growths in the available cash in the policy are guaranteed. No matter what happens, doesn't matter what the performance of the life insurance company's portfolio is, that you're going to get the non-guaranteed. That's what's taking into account what's called dividends. All right. And so there they're saying, if we do better than the bare minimum that we're projecting here, that we're guaranteeing, we're going to have a surplus. We will distribute that to our policyholders. The way this policy is constructed, you are eligible for dividends. Because remember, folks, it's a dividend paying whole life policy. That's what we're talking about here. And so if you get those and then roll those back into buying more life insurance, so augmenting your existing policy by buying more, then here's how that thing will grow over time too. But those are projections. They're non-guaranteed because, again, they're not guaranteeing you dividends up front. They're just saying, you know, in all likelihood, because we're very conservative with these estimates, we're going to do better probably than this sort of, you know, very conservative, pessimistic baseline projection that we're making. And so in that case, when we have more money to play with than the bare minimum we are guaranteeing, we will then distribute some of that to you in the form of a dividend. So here's historically, based on our patterns and our projections, here's probably how this policy will perform if you take it out. But again, the more conservative figures are the ones that are guaranteed. So Adam, do you want to speak to that at all, Carlos, before we move on?
No, I think that's very well said, and you're right. Generally, the guaranteed amounts always are lined up on the left-hand side of columns of the illustrations, and then you see the non-guaranteed portions on the right-hand side. And you're right to say that the insurance companies are very, very conservative, even on their projected amounts. You know, you have to think about the insurance companies. They're just like a giant trust, okay? So we entrust money to these insurance companies, and they act as a sort of a trustee. And again, they're regulated by the states, not the federal government. And so the states have a very keen interest, because they act like trusts, you know, make sure that these life insurance companies are doing everything very conservatively And they're always being paying very close attention to the solvency of these companies. So that's what you will see in getting the illustration, exactly what Bob just said. Guaranteed, and there's very few, actually there's very few things like this where you can actually see what the company's guaranteeing you, especially with a dividend paying whole life. So it's good to see these numbers going from whenever you get the policy right now all the way to the end of your life and seeing, okay, this is exactly what this insurance company is saying. We will guarantee you this amount of money, and you can actually see it going down the column.
Yeah. So just as an aside, Carlos mentions that point. Keep that in mind when you're looking at the performance of one of these things versus some other possible investment that you might put your money into. That, again, remember, folks, the point of doing this is not that you're, quote, investing in life insurance, that this is more of a headquarters for your money so that you can then deploy your money when you see other investment opportunities. But I'm saying even if you were just looking at it in terms of one asset versus another, I've seen a lot of comparisons people make where they will just look at like the historical rate of return on a mutual fund and compare that with the historical rate of return on a whole life policy, for someone who just left it sitting in the drawer. And that's an invalid comparison, because if somebody's looking at an equity-based mutual fund and saying, oh, wow, look, this has got 12% annually on average over the past such and such, that's misleading in several ways. But one of the reasons that's an invalid comparison is if you had your money just in a purely equity-based mutual fund, I mean, that thing may have been down 40% at some point in the 2008 crisis, whereas a whole life policy cannot go down, right? So once you it goes up, it ratchets up, it can't go down. And then further, there is very, modest to be sure, but nonetheless guaranteed growth in the policy. So it's not simply that the thing you expect it to grow decently over time. It's that once it goes up, it can't go down, and you are guaranteed that stepwise increase annually because of the guaranteed growth in the cash value that's built in contractually. So again, keep that in mind when you're looking at these things. There are pros and cons of various types of uses of your money, to be sure, but make sure you understand just how sturdy the dividend-paying whole life policy is. Because again, I've seen a lot of supposedly qualified financial gurus, poo-pooing a whole life policy, and they don't even explain what its merits are. Okay, let me bring up something here that this may be common sense, but go ahead and say it. As with any major financial decision, if you're married, make sure your spouse is on board with this and at least knows enough about it to get the big picture. But in particular, the reason it's really important that the spouse understands IBC, at least the big picture of it, is because remember what's happening here. You are going to get a dividend-paying whole life policy, and the cash available in it is going to grow over time, particularly if you structure it a certain way. The cash is going to grow more rapidly than it would with just a standard plain vanilla whole life policy. And then when you have to make a large purchase, instead of you going to an outside lender, you're going to go to the life insurance company, take out a policy loan with your cash surrender value as the collateral on that loan. Okay, so again, contractually, legally, what's happening is the life insurance company on the side is giving you a loan at a guaranteed interest rate, and the surrender cash value in your life insurance policy is the collateral for that loan. Okay. So what that means is at any given time, if you have an outstanding policy loan balance, then that is in effect a lien against your life insurance policy. So if you die and your wife, let's say, thought you had $1 million in death benefit because of this whole life policy that you had been funding for a long time. And then, but she didn't realize you had an outstanding $100,000 policy loan. Well, then the life insurance company, they're not going to send the full $1 million death benefit to the named beneficiary. Instead, they're going to first pay off the policy loan. So if it happened to be $100,000 at the moment of death, that's only a $900,000 check that's going out the door of the life insurance company to the beneficiary. So if the beneficiary had been thinking all along, oh yeah, I've got $1 million coming to me, and then gets a $900,000 and is shocked to discover there was this outstanding policy loan, there could be some strong words, right? So that's why in particular, just obviously in general, it's smart that if you're married, your spouse is on board with major financial decisions. But beyond that, in this particular case, I think it's extra important simply because of the nature of IBC, and you really need to be aware of the fact and make sure all your the people who may be beneficiaries in that policy understand how that works. And so there's no surprises. So Carlos, do you want to say anything else about that?
Well, that's a very good point, Bob, what you're bringing there. Yes, I agree with what you're saying. You should bring your spouse into this. You see, first of all, we're all Keynesians. All of us are. We were all, by that I mean we were all educated in Keynesian schools. Even Robert got his PhD in a Keynesian school. Because you don't actually, you know, are taught Austrian economics. We're, in a sense, all self-taught. But the Keynesian mentality, of course, is to keep us away from saving our money, okay? When they talk about saving, they're talking about basically accumulation of money that can later be, you know, taxed and or subject to volatility of the markets, okay? Now, when you're accessing or getting a dividend-paying whole life policy, it's not so much about accumulating the money in the form of savings, even though you are doing exactly that. It's more about the utilization of that money. So you're wanting to utilize that money to buy all your big ticket items of life. But Robert's making a very good point. You know, you're going to wind up, you know, buying cars, paying for education. You're maybe even eliminating debt once you understand how these policies work. So you're going to be using the policy loans, you know, quite frequently during the period that you have that. Now, eventually, you'll want to keep paying back the loans because at some point later in life, you may want to annuitize the policy and just basically create tax-free income for yourself. So it's very versatile in a lot of different ways, but the point that Bob is making is very key, is that your spouse should know that you're borrowing money that may be eventually reduced from the death benefit that she would get as a beneficiary.
And while I'm in the midst of making what may be elementary observations, but again, just because I've had people have this confusion, so let me end the angst for some of you. Let me be clear. So when you'll see illustrations, either in Nelson's book or the actual illustrations, if you're meeting with somebody, make sure when you're looking at those things, you understand that one column will show the cash surrender value, and the other column, you know, perhaps right next to it or a few columns over, will show what the death benefit is at that moment. And what you should make sure you understand is you don't get both. Okay, the surrender value, that's is saying, like, if you walked away from the policy, that's the spot amount they would pay you. So that's always going to be less than the death benefit. And but if you happen to die in that year, then you would just get the death benefit. You're not getting the death benefit and the cash value on top of that, right? That would be misconstruing what the cash value is if you were thinking like that. But nonetheless, to avoid confusion, since we're offering this podcast episode to newbies, let me just make sure you're aware of that. One last thing. Now this could be a huge thing. So I'm afraid of opening Pandora's box here, but I do want to, the last point I wanted to make was just to explain to people, what is happening. If you look at an illustration and you see that the death benefit is going up, is you're actually buying more life insurance. Okay. And it's what's called, you're getting paid up additional life insurance. And that's why the death benefit is rising, right? So if you just took out a regular policy and just merely paid the premiums, and then if they gave you dividends, you just pocketed them and, you know, went and bought ice cream with them or whatever, then the death benefit wouldn't grow. That would just be a regular, like, insurance as you're probably normally picturing it in other contexts where you're making a premium payment to keep a certain level of death benefit coverage in force. So the reason the death benefit, like in Nelson Nash's illustrations and probably ones you're going to see from financial professionals who are showing you, you know, a policy designed for the purposes of IBC, you're going to see that death benefit go up over time. And that's because, again, what's actually happening underneath the hood is you are using money. You're not merely paying the bare minimum premium to keep the original policy in force, but you're using extra money to buy paid up additional insurance. And so that's why the death benefit's going up. It's almost like you're buying little mini policies that are supplementing the original one, and each little mini policy has a little bit of extra death benefit coverage, And then for the purpose of the illustration, they're just consolidating all that and showing you the sum of the total death benefit coverage. So what? So they're just, you should just know that just for your own awareness as to why the death benefit's rising. But the other thing is, and again, I realize this is a huge topic, and so we don't want to dwell too much on it. I just want to make you aware to avoid confusion. There's ways that these policies can be configured, and this is the kind of thing you want to think about and then know. So when you talk to somebody you find on the practitioner finder, you can bring up what your goals are, what your preferences are, that you can make it so these things have the ability that you, if you have a windfall, that you can put in more money than you want to be on the hook for, as it were. So you just keep that in mind. That is one of the options with these things, is you can think through and say, okay, for sure on a typical month, I'm going to be able to put at least this much into one of these policies, and I want to be doing that because I've read Nelson's book. I see the value in this thing, and I want to capitalize my my policy and get it up to speed so that it's got big cash value sooner rather than later, so I can start using it in the IBC way. But you know what? Just with my finances right now, I don't think I can be sure in any given month that I can make more than this payment. However, sometimes I have better months than others, and it is possible a lot of times I'm going to want to put more than this in the policy, but I don't want to have to. And so there is that ability. I don't think it's, we should really get into the mechanics of that as to how that's happening, but I just want to make you folks aware that there is that possibility. So make sure you bring that kind of thing up with the financial professional to say, what do you want? Like, do you just want to say that this is the number and that's what it's going to be, and just give me a policy that I can put that much in, end of story? Or do you want a corridor, if you will, to be able to put in more if you have a windfall? So I'll stop there, Carlos. Do you want to say anything on that?
No, again, that was a good, very important piece to bring up. And yes, your authorized IBC practitioner will certainly be able to cover all those aspects of the policy with you. I think we've summarized this particular podcast very well. If you've listened to 17 and now this one, the only last thing I want to say is we're hopeful, and we think you will have a good experience in your conversation with the practitioner. IBC is growing. It's becoming very, very popular. And for that reason, I think you're going to see a lot of imitators out there. And they're already out there. So this is the reason we created the program, the education program for financial professionals. This is why we have the finder here, because we have you, the general public, in mind. You know, this is who we're thinking about when we put this not only the course, but also the finder. And of course, that all impacts the building of the 10%, which we want to invite as many financial professionals to come into our program. But at the same time, we're very rigorous with it. We're actually, these professionals, they don't just get into this program. They have to be interviewed by us. So they have to have the right mindset. They have to understand that it's the client. We're trying to help the client. Everybody's going to win by getting an IBC policy. Everybody. It's a really, truly a win-win situation for everybody. But we feel very comfortable now that we've set up this program, that we set up the finder for you, for your benefit and your safety.
That's exactly right. And again, the finder will have the direct link at the show notes page. This is episode 18 you're listening to right now, The Lara Murphy Show. But if you want to go directly to it, it's infinitebanking.org/finder is where you will see the list of people who have been through our program, and they know all the stuff that Carlos and I have talked about here. But when they meet with you and you start talking about these things, they're going to be so pleasantly surprised. They say, wow, this person really is sharp and on the ball. We've just saved ourselves 20 minutes of needless conversation. Let's get right into the good stuff. So thanks for listening, everyone. We are Bob Murphy and Carlos Lara of The Lara Murphy Show, where you hear financial analysis from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. As always, we urge you to share the podcast with people who may be interested in it. You know what? Share it with people who might not be interested in it too, because they should be, and maybe it'll turn them around. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.
You've just finished another episode of The Lara Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LauraMurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.